roaring up out of sleaze, poems from ice, from vomit, and from tainted blood. This is the time for stiff or viscous poems, big and big. But that doesn't mean, all of you poets here know, I'm sure, that you have to create an epic in order to achieve bigness. Because bigness can be found in a little haiku. Five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables. Well, let's start with love. As I know just about everybody in this room is in love. Or at least you are in love with the concept of love. I'm going to read you a poem called When You Have Forgotten Sunday, The Love Story. Some of you have seen it in Ebony magazine because they have reprinted it three times. I love to read love poems to young people especially, because I like to watch them nudging each other and whispering to each other. I know what they're saying. They're saying, listen to that old woman talking about love. What does she know about love? But I am here to tell you that I was married for 57 years, just short 2 months. And my husband died, as many of you know, last July 3rd. But I like to tell my young listeners that that is true, and that we also had two children who arrived in, I assure you, in what used to be the usual way. So I think I have a right to speak to you about love. This testifies to the adolescence of our marriage. And when you have forgotten the bright bedclothes on a Wednesday or a Saturday and a Saturday, and most especially, when you have forgotten Sunday, when you have forgotten Sunday halves in bed, or me sitting on the front room radiator in the limping afternoon, looking off down the long, the long street to nowhere, hugged by my plain old wrapper of no expectation and nothing I have to do, and I'm happy, why, and if Monday never had to come. When you have forgotten that, I say, and how you swore if somebody beeped the bell, and how my heart played hopscotch if the telephone rang, and how we finally went into Sunday dinner. That is to say, went across the front room floor to the ink-spotted table in the southwest corner to Sunday dinner, which was always chicken and noodles, or chicken and rice, and salad, and rye bread, and tea, and chocolate chip cookies. I say, when you have forgotten that. When you have forgotten my little presentiment that the war would be over before they got to you, and how we finally undressed and whipped out the light and flowed into bed and lay loose-limbed for a moment in the weekend bright bedclothes, then gently folded into each other. When you have, I say, forgotten all that, then you may tell, then I may believe you have forgot me. Well, now the youngsters may giggle at this point. Behind the scenes, when I say a president, a vice president, a secretary of state on sparkling tile, beside noble columns of white, I think to myself, somebody got there early and swept and scrubbed. Somebody dusted. Before the president came, somebody buffed his shoes. The not too stiffened white of his shirt was not achieved by his own agility. At the invisible controls, some little weak-kneed, stricken, or powerful woman or man. Hope you'll all remember that it is the little people, I like to spell it LITTUL, who really essentially conduct this world. They have no red parades. They have no memorials as a rule, no headlines, but there they are, everlastingly working and achieving. Now I'm going to introduce to you, going to read you all kinds of poems. And right now I want to introduce to you Some Children Coming Home. That's the name of this little book. And I'm sure many of you have seen this kind of formation. I travel a lot, and I see this presentation on many campuses. I'm sure some of you have got notebooks like this. And I had such when I was in school. So I thought it was just the right introduction to a batch of poems. All of them are short, and I'm not going to read them all. Do not be fearful. Featuring children who have been dismissed from school and are on their way home to a variety of situations. Not everybody is coming home to what I came home to, cookies and cocoa, and a nice little fresh mother there in her little flowered house dress, or those aprons that women used to wear of interesting design, offering, as I think I said, cookies and cocoa to her two children, and saying that wonderful thing that many of you have heard, and if you have heard it, I know that you feel, as I feel, that you were very fortunate. What did you learn in school today? And wanted to know. Well, Tinsel Marie is a little girl on her way home, not to cookies and cocoa. And I named her poem, The Koora Flower, C-O-O-R-A, The Koora Flower. Tinsel Marie is a very hip little sister. She is no stranger to irony. Today I learned the Koora flower grows high in the mountains of Itigolupa Besa, province Michi, Pop 39. Now I am coming home. This at least is real, and what I know. It was restful learning, nothing necessary. School is tiny vacation. At least you can sleep. At least you can think of love or feeling your boyfriend against you, which is not free from grief. But now it's real business. I am coming home. My mother will be screaming in an almost dirty dress. The crack is gone, so a man will be in the house. I must watch myself. I must not dare to sleep. Jamal is a little boy who has parents who are always bickering, always trying to jump in front of each other, to supersede each other. When I was 5 years old, I was on a train. From a train window, I saw 19 cows in a slow line walking. Each cow was behind a friend, except for the first cow, who was God. I smiled until one cow near the end jumped in front of a friend. That reminded me of my mother and of my father. It spelled what is there together. I was sorry for the spelling lesson. I turned my face from the glass. Richard Dean is one of those little black girls that you often see with almost no hair on their heads. And some of you perhaps look at them with pity. But they don't pity themselves. I imagine there might be one or two or three who might wish they had long flowing waves. But most of those little girls feel that their heads are sculpture, their art, and that is what they are proud to expose to your attention. Richard Dean has seen something outdoors over and over again, and she is so surprised. White girls are peculiar people. They cannot keep their hands out of their hair. Also, they are always shaking it away from their eyes when it is not in their eyes. Sometimes when it is braided, they forget. Shake, shake, and smooth what is nothing away from their shameless eyes. I laugh. My hair is short. It is close to my head. It is almost a crown of dots. My head is clean and free. I do not shake my head to make my brains like a crazy dust. Here is a poem. Oh, I should have told you. Thank you. I should have told you that at the front of this book, I have the legend created by Mari Evans, a wonderful black poet who lives in Indianapolis. What she said so long ago, speak the truth to the people. Speak the truth to the people. And I really should have read that to you first so you would be prepared for anything I might have to say here. Personally, I feel there's no point in picking up pen and paper or in these times your computer unless you intend to put upon that paper your truth, your observed or experienced truth. So here is a poem featuring Kojo. I meet lots of Kojos and Kojoettes, though I suppose that's not politically correct. And I'm so proud of them because they want to be exactly what they are. They don't want to be anything else than what they are. Kojo's poem is called I Am a Black. According to my teachers, I am now an African American. They call me out of my name. Black is an open umbrella. I am black and a black forever. I am one of the blacks. We are here, we are there. We occur in Brazil, in Nigeria, Ghana, in Botswana, Tanzania, in Kenya, in Russia, Australia, in Haiti, Soweto, in Grenada, in Cuba, in Panama, Libya, in England and Italy, France. We are graces in any places. I am black and a black forever. I am other than hyphenation. I say proudly, my people. I say proudly, our people. Our people do not disdain to eat yams or melons or grits or to put peanut butter in stew. And I always like to interrupt myself here and tell you that if you have not tried that, you try it. Some of you must have tried it. And I recommend the chunky rather than the smooth. I am Kojo in West Africa. Kojo means unconquerable. My parents named me the seventh day from my birth. In black spirit, black faith, black communion. I am Kojo. I am a black and I capitalize my name. Do not call me out of my name. Now let me introduce you to a little family. Let me introduce you to a little family that maybe you wouldn't want to live next door to. But there are at least two positives in this poem, and I'm sure you'll recognize them. Ulysses is speaking in a poem called Religion. At home, we pray every morning. We get down on our knees in a circle, holding hands, holding love, and we sing hallelujah. Then we go into the world. Daddy speeds to break bread with his girlfriend. Mommy's a boss and a lesbian. She too has a nice girlfriend. My brothers and sisters and I come to school. We bring knives, pistols, bottles, little boxes, and cans. We talk to the man who's cool at the playground gate. Nobody sees us. Nobody stops our sin. Our teachers feed us geography. We spit it out in a hurry. Now we are coming home. At home, we pray every evening. We get down on our knees in a circle, holding hands, holding love, and we sing hallelujah. Well, now those two positives are, one, that they do come together morning and evening in some degree of communion, and I believe therein lies a positive. And the line, nobody sees us, nobody stops our sin, is a positive because it is a cry for help, and a cry for help is always positive. I want to introduce you to Merle, a little boy. He tells you how old he is. His name is spelled M-E-R-L-E, and his poem is called Uncle Seagram. Uncle Seagram. Many of you know, don't you, that there are many strange parents who name their children after whiskeys. So we have Calvert, we have Johnny Walker, and you can add from your catalog whatever you choose. Uncle Seagram. My uncle likes me too much. I am 5 1/2 years old and in kindergarten. In kindergarten, everything is clean. My uncle is 6 feet tall with 7 bumps on his chin. My uncle is 6 feet tall and he stumbles. He stumbles because of his wonderful medicine packed in his pocket all times. Family is Ma and Pa and my uncle. 3 brothers, 3 sisters, and me. Every night at my house, we play checkers and dominoes. My uncle sits close. There aren't any shoes or socks on his feet. Under the table, a big toe tickles my ankle. Under the oilcloth, his thin knee beats into mine and mashes and mashes. When we look at TV, my uncle picks me to sit on his lap. As I sit, he gets hard in the middle. I squirm, but he keeps me and kisses my ear. I am not even a girl. Once, when I went to the bathroom, my uncle noticed. Came in, shut the door, put his long white tongue in my ear, and whispered, "We're best friends and family, and we know how to keep secrets. My uncle likes me too much. I am worried. I do not like my uncle anymore." Well, now, almost always when I read that poem in elementary schools or high schools, somebody speaks to me afterward and says, "That's happening in my family," or "That has happened in my home." I've heard that from 6-year-olds and from 15-year-olds. So, of course, I just have to put more burdens on the overburdened backs of the teachers. And I say, "Speak to your teacher about that. Something will be done for you." And the teachers assure me that in some cases that I have happened to hear of later, that they have followed that up. But to hide it, to try to hide it and put a cover over it is not the answer, I believe. I want to introduce you to Diego. On this day, the day of this poem, Diego is puzzled because it's called Black Pride Day in his school. And the other children, the ones who are, as they like to think, purely black, have been running around school, putting up their hands like this, you know, and saying, "I'm black and I'm proud," and all that kind of excitement has been going on around Diego, and he does not know what to make of it. I, partly Nigerian. I, partly Puerto Rican. I have a Nigerian father, a Puerto Rican mother. I am packed in a skin that is tan. I, too, have a heart on fire. I, too, want to be proud. I, too, want to be something and proud. I want to shout, "I'm a tan." Chocolates down here. Well, let me read you some other kinds of poems. I'll read a poem that you may have read on the first page of the New York Times, because strangely enough, some years ago, that's where it landed, with interesting commentary. Some teachers, students tell me, have been told that I am the feature of this poem. That is not true. If it were true, I would certainly tell you. Because in this time when everybody tells everybody everything about everything, it would be your right to know. But the feature here is an old friend of mine, Pearl, long since gone to her reward. And she had several abortions. She told me what her response to her trauma had been. Not every woman responds to this situation as Pearl or any other woman does. Each response is individual. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You will never neglect or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh. Return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind, the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted, I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, aches, and your deaths, if I poison the beginnings of your breaths. Believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. So why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead, or rather, or instead, you were never made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you had body, you died. It is just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you all. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly, and I loved you. Oh, let me recite We Real Cool before I forget to do that. The pool players, seven at the golden shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. Now, most kids don't say it like that. They say, we real cool, we left school, we lurk late, strike straight. And I like that. They're popping their fingers. You notice I didn't do that. But there are other ways to say the poem. I say it my way because I want you to stop at the we at the end of each line till you get to the last. Because these are boys who feel that they are not cherished by their society. And although it's kept pretty quiet among themselves, I believe that they would like to have some affection of some kind from somebody. So I want you to pause and give them an instant of complete attention, just for a split second. Does that make any sense to you? Anyway. Here is an old black woman, homeless and indistinct. I know there are lots of homeless out here. I didn't see any, though. When I don't see any, I often ask, I haven't seen your homeless. Where do you keep them? And sometimes I get interesting answers. Well, if you really have never seen a homeless person, well, think of, in the flesh I mean, think of those you have seen on TV while you listen to this poem. An old black woman, homeless and indistinct. Your every day is a pilgrimage, a blue hubbub. Your days are collected bacchanals of fear and self-troubling. And your nights, when you put you down in alley or cardboard or viaduct, your lovers are rats finding your secret places. When you rise in another morning, you hit the street, your incessant enemy. See? Here you are in the so busy world. You walk, you pass the people. No, the people pass you. Here's a rich girl marching briskly to her charms. She is suede and scarf and belting and perfume. She sees you not, she sees you very well. At 5 in the afternoon, Miss Rich Girl will go home to brooms and vacuum cleaner and carpeting, two cats, two marble top tables, two telephones, shiny green peppers, flowers in impudent vases, visitors. Before all that, there's luncheon to be known. Lasagna, lobster salad, sandwiches. All day there's coffee to be loved. There are luxuries of minor dissatisfaction, luxuries of plan. That's her story. You're going to vanish, not necessarily nicely, fairly soon. Although essentially dignity itself, a death is not necessarily tidy, modest, or discreet. When they find you, your mouth may not be tidy nor aligned. Your mouth may be all crooked or destroyed. Black old woman, homeless, indistinct, your last and least adventure is review. Going far. Now let me go way back in history to my first book. I'm going to... Thank you. Thank you. Is that because I'm going way back in history or because you like that book? I want to read to you a poem called A Brownsville Mother Loiters in Mississippi. Meanwhile, a Mississippi mother burns bacon. And many of you, I'm sure, remember the Emmett Till murder case. Way back in 54, Emmett Till, a Chicago boy of 14, came to Money, Mississippi, to visit his relatives. One afternoon, it is said, I was not there, it is said, he took a walk along a country road, sunny afternoon, and he saw a pretty young white woman standing in front of the store that she ran with her husband. I'm pretty sure that husband's name was Roy Milam. M-I-L-A-M, I think. And The newspapers later on kept saying how handsome he was. He was almost pretty. So Emmett Till supposedly whistled at this woman, and she was indignant. And when her husband came home, she told him what had happened, this outrage. And also, she told his friend, Big Fellow, that's what they called him. And those two went to ferret out Emmett Till from his uncle's home. I hope I'm getting all these minor details exactly right. But those two dragged him out of there and brutally murdered him. And there was a trial, and of course they were freed. So I decided I had to write a poem on this subject. My own son was 14 at that very time. He too was mischievous. Who knows what would have happened to him if he had been in Money, Mississippi with Emmett Till. So I decided I would write the poem from the viewpoint of the young woman, the store owner, the wife of Ray Milo. And I've been scolded for this. I've been told, you should have written it from the viewpoint of Emmett Till or of his mother, but not this woman. I wanted to believe that this woman would respond in the way I have her responding in this poem. From the first, well, she's thinking of all the events as though part of a ballad, the kind that she had learned in school. From the first, it had been like a ballad. It had the beat inevitable. It had the blood. A wildness cut up and tied in little bunches. Like the four-line stanzas of the ballads, she had never quite understood the ballads they had set her to in school. Herself, the milk-white maid, the maid mild of the ballad, pursued by the dark villain, rescued by the fine prince, the happiness ever after. That was worth anything. It was good to be a maid mild. That made the breath go fast. Her bacon burned. She hastened to hide it in the step-on can and drew more strips from the meat case. The eggs and sour milk biscuits did well. She set out a jar of her new quince preserve. But there was a something about the matter of the dark villain. He should have been older, perhaps. The hacking down of a villain was more fun to think about when his menace possessed undisputed breadth, undisputed height, and a harsh kind of vice. And best of all, when his history was cluttered with the bones of many eaten knights and princesses. The fun was disturbed, then all but nullified, when the dark villain was a blackish child of 14 with eyes still too young to be dirty and a mouth too young to have lost every reminder of its infant softness. That boy must have been surprised, for these were grown-ups. Grown-ups were supposed to be wise, and the fine prince and that other, so tall, so broad, so grown. Perhaps the boy had never guessed that the trouble with grown-ups was that under the magnificent shell of adulthood, just under, waited the baby full of tantrums. It occurred to her that there may have been something ridiculous in the picture of the fine prince, rushing, rich with the breadth and height and mature solidness whose lack in the dark villain was impressing her, confronting her more and more as this first day after the trial and acquittal wore on, rushing with his heavy companion to hack down, unhorsed, that little foe. So much had happened, she could not remember now what that foe had done against her, or if anything had been done. The one thing in the world that she did know and knew with terrifying clarity was that her composition had disintegrated, that although the pattern prevailed, the breaks were everywhere, that she could think of no thread capable of the necessary sew work. She made the baby sit in their places at the table. Then, before calling him, she hurried to the mirror with her comb and lipstick. It was necessary to be more beautiful than ever, the beautiful wife. For sometimes, she fancied, he looked at her as though measuring her, as if he considered, had she been worth it? Had she been worth the blood, the cramped cries, the little stuttering bravado, the gradual dulling of those Negro eyes, the sudden, overwhelming little boyness in that burn. Whatever she might feel or have feel, the lipstick necessity was something apart. He must never conclude that she had not been worth it. He sat down, the fine prince, and began buttering a biscuit. He looked at his hands. He twisted in his chair. He scratched his nose. He glanced again, almost secretly, at his hands. More papers were in from the north, he mumbled. More meddling headlines, with their pepper words, bestiality, and barbarism, and shocking. The half sneers he had mastered for the trial worked across his sweet and pretty face. What he'd like to do, he explained, was kill them all. The time lost, the unwanted fame. Still, it had been fun to show those intruders a thing or two, to show that snappy-eyed mother, that sassy northern brown-black. Nothing could stop Mississippi. He knew that. Big fella knew that. And what was so good, Mississippi knew that. Nothing and nothing could stop Mississippi. They could send in their petitions and scar their newspapers with bleeding headlines. Their governors could appeal to Washington. What I want, the older baby said, is lasses on my jam. Whereupon the younger baby picked up the molasses pitcher and threw the molasses in his brother's face. Instantly, the fine prince leaned across the table and slapped the small and smiling criminal. She did not speak when the hand came down and away, and she could look at her child, at her baby child. She could think only of blood. Surely her baby's cheek had disappeared, and in its place, surely, hung a heaviness, a lengthening red, a red that had no end. She shook her head. It was not true, of course. It was not true at all. The child's face was, as always, the color of the paste in her paste jar. She left the table to the tune of the children's lamentations, which were shriller than ever. She looked out of a window. She said not a word. That was one of the new somethings. The fear tying her as with iron. Suddenly, she felt his hands upon her. He had followed her to the window. The children were whimpering now, such bits of tots, and she, their mother, could not protect them. She looked at her shoulders, still gripped in the claim of his hands. She tried, but could not resist the idea that a red ooze was seeping, spreading darkly, thickly, slowly over her white shoulders, her own shoulders, and over all of Earth and Mars. He whispered something to her. Did the fine prince? Something about love. Something about love and night and intention. She heard no hoofbeat of the horse and saw no flash of the shining steel. He pulled her face around to meet his, and there it was, close, close, for the first time in those days and nights, his mouth wet and red, so very, very, very red, closed over hers. Then a sickness heaved within her. The courtroom Coca-Cola, the courtroom fear and hate and sweat and drone pushed like a wall against her. She wanted to bear it, but his mouth would not go away, and neither would the decapitated exclamation points in that other woman's eyes. She did not scream. She stood there. But a hatred for him burst into glorious flower, and its perfume enclasped them. Big, bigger than all magnolias, the last bleak news of the ballad, the rest of the rugged music, the last quatrain. I'm going to read you a real ballad now. Thank you very much. I'm going to read you a ballad, one that I read here 20 years ago, because this poem is in my first book. And it has a connection, or at least my additions to it have a connection with this campus. After that, let me see, I'd better start thinking about letting you go. I'll read only two more poems after this. One will be Gottschalk and the Grand Tarantelle, and the last one will be Infirm. But when I read this poem here some 20 years ago, a young fella in the audience here, seems to me he was over there near the back. And after I had read the poem, he said, "I hear you, sister." And I won't tell all of his name, but part of it is M. White. And He's not here tonight. I understand he's in Waco, Texas. But I salute him with this reading of Ballad of Pearl Bailey, which was also Langston Hughes' favorite among my poems that he knew. Langston was a mischief as well as an integritous noble. And he wrote several columns about Pearly May, as he liked to call her. This is a story of love and lynching, and I hope that you will believe that Pearl May Lee was very much in love. That will account for some of her, you might say, curious responses. Then off they took you, off to the jail. 100 hooting after, and you should have heard me at my house. I cut my lungs with my laughter. Laughter, laughter. Cut my lungs with my laughter. They dragged you into a dusty cell, and a rat was in the corner. And what was I doing? Laughing still, though never was a poor gal lorner. Lorner, lorner. Never was a poor gal lorner. Sheriff, he peeped in through the bars, and the red old thing, he told you, you son of a bitch, you're going to hell, 'cause you wanted white arms to enfold you. Enfold you. Enfold you. 'Cause you wanted white arms to enfold you. But you paid for your white arms, Sammy boy, and you didn't pay with money. You paid with your hide and my heart, Sammy boy, for your taste of pink and white honey. 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 Your taste of pink and white honey. Oh, dig me out of my dump despair. Pull me out of my poor me. Get me a garment of red to wear. You had it coming. Surely, surely, surely. You had it coming. Surely. At school, your girls were the bright little girls. You couldn't abide dark meat. Yellow was for to look at, black for the famished to eat. Yellow was for to look at, black for the famished to eat. You grew up with bright skins on the brain, and me in your black folks' bed. Often and often you cut me cold. Often I wished you dead. Often and often you cut me cold. And often I wished you dead. White girl passed you by one day, and the vixen she gave you the wink, and your stomach got sick and your legs liquefied, and you thought till you couldn't think. You thought. You thought till you couldn't think. I fancy you out on the fringe of town, the moon and owl's eye minding, the sweet and thick of the cricket bell dark, the fire within you winding, 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 the fire within you winding. Say, she was white like milk, though, wasn't she? And her breasts were cups of cream. In the back of her Buick, you drank your fill. Then she roused you out of your dream. In the back of her Buick, you drank your fill. Then she roused you out of your dream. You rape me, nigger, she softly said. The shame was threading through. You rape me, nigger, and what the hell do you think I'm going to do? What the hell, what the hell do you think I'm going to do? I'll tell every white man in this town. I'll tell them all of my sorrow. You got my body tonight, nigger boy. I'll get your spotty tomorrow. Morrow, tomorrow, I'll get your body tomorrow. And my glory, but Sammy, she did, and they stole you out of the jail. They wrapped you around a cottonwood tree, and they laughed when they heard you wail. Laughed. They laughed when they heard you wail. And I was laughing down at my house, laughing fit to kill. You got what you wanted for dinner, but brother, you paid the bill. Brother, you paid the bill. Paid for your dinner, Sammy boy, and you didn't pay with money. You paid with your hide and my heart, Sammy boy, for your taste of pink and white honey. Honey! Your taste of pink and white honey. Oh, dig me out of my dump despair. Pull me out of my poor me. Get me a garment of red to wear. You had it coming, surely. Surely. You had it coming. You had it coming. Surely. I'll have to get your name. Bless your hearts. Thank you. Gosh. Bless your hearts. Thank you. I want to introduce you to Louis Moreau Gottschalk. The musicians here will know him, Louis Moreau Gottschalk, a very famous composer and pianist. And he was born in 1830 in New Orleans. And Gottschalk liked to sneak up behind the slaves in the shadows, and he loved to listen to them and to watch them dancing. Some of their dancing reminded him of tarantulas, and hence that very famous piece, The Grand Tarantelle. I'm going to invite you to think of people like Elvis Presley and Vanilla Ice, and later on, you'll be able to add others to that little catalog as I read this poem. I'm addressing the slaves. My black brothers and sisters, nimble slaves in New Orleans, dancing to your own music, loving your wild art, your art, vertical, winnowing, willful. You did not know that Gottschalk was watching, was hearing. Slouched in the offing, he was. Crouching most shamefully, he was. Stealthy, heavily breathing. He fell in love with your music. Died at 40, but before that he created Le Banjo. An American sketch. He created piano pieces based on slave dances. He created piano pieces based on tunes he heard in the Congo. Early he stole the wealth of your art. Wrongfully he bore it away to the white side of town. You never knowing. And there he doctored the dear purity. He whitened your art and named it his own. He traded it for money in great halls of whiteness. He sold it to thronging white company. The patrons went mad, loving odd music, embroidered savagery. Women wept and wilted. They cut off and wore his hair. He became the lapel piece composer. His concerts and conquests multiplied. He handled many a money. And he died at 40, an over-musicked man. He rose across you, black beauty. Stole your art. He never passed you a penny, nor painted your name on a page. But hark, he inherited slaves from his father and freed them. All hail the debt payer. It's a mean little poem. Thank you very much. This is the last poem in what I hope has not been too long a program. It's called It's called Infirm. And some of you have heard it before because Patti LaBelle included it in her TV piece called Going Home to Gospel. I'd been told she was going to use it, and of course I was very proud of that. But I had hoped that she would sing it, and she did not sing it. She just said it, which is what I'm going to do. Infirm. Everybody here is infirm. Everybody here is infirm. Mend me. Mend me, Lord. Today I say to them, Lord, look, I am beautiful, beautiful with my wing that is wounded, my eye that is bonded, or my ear not funded, or my walk all a wobble. I'm enough to be beautiful. You are beautiful, too. And I just want to tell you, I am so glad that I lived long enough to find out what true beauty is. Motion is true beauty. If you can move, you are beautiful. Thank you very much. I don't know how much time you have, but I understand that there are to be some questions and answers. If you want to ask me anything, I'll try to answer intelligently. Any questions? I certainly want to thank you for the beautiful way that you have received me for 2 days. I've had a great time here. I've looked forward to coming back to Berkeley. I will answer a couple of questions. One is, a question I often get is, when did you start writing poetry? And I can answer that for you. My mother said that I was 7 years old when I brought her a page of rhymes. And she was very proud of me. And she said, you are going to be the Lady Paul Laurence Dunbar. And Well, now, what does that mean? Nobody really wants to be like another poet, but of course I thought it was great praise in those days. So I kept writing poetry, and when I was writing a poem, my brother had to wash the dishes. And when he was painting a picture, I had to wash the dishes. We had wonderful, supportive parents. Well, I'm going to be out in the lobby or somewhere, you'll tell them, signing, and we'll talk personally.
But we want you to stand right here for just a moment, Ms. Brooks. Professor Barbara Christian has a special announcement.
Yes. Oh, I'm recovering from the reading. We were trying to think of what could we possibly do in order to show our appreciation for the beautiful poetry, the truth that you've given us for so many years. And we know you have plaques and you have citations and you have honorary degrees. So we thought, in the spirit of what you've done for so many, many years in working with our young people, that perhaps what we could do was to, in your name, to gift to students in high schools in this area the Norton Anthology of African American Literature. So that there are students who are going to get Norton's, from McClyman's, from Berkeley High, from Puente Project, and from Dewey Alternative High School, in Gwendolyn Brooks' name. We thank you so much for this evening.